Welcome to Worlds Apart. One of the basic premises of modern psychology is that while patterns of development are universal, each psyche, each individual will have to come up with his or her own solutions to the problems posed by life. That seems natural, and yet when it comes to the collective level, there still seem to be good or bad ways to be or to develop, regardless of a nation's history, culture, or collective traumas. With such a zeal for uniformity, can we ever put an end to our inner or outer conflicts? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Richard Sakwa, Professor Emeritus of Russian and European Politics at the University of Kent. Professor Sakwa, it's great to talk to you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Hello.
I mentioned psychology in my introduction because I do think that geopolitics would benefit from a better knowledge of how collective psyche works. And you also deal with some of those issues indirectly in your new book, The Lost Peace and How the West Failed to Prevent a New Cold War. Let's start with the title. Was there ever a lasting peace to be lost? And did the West just fail to prevent a new confrontation? Or did it actively help bringing it about?
There wasn't a lasting peace, definitely not. But I think that at the end of the 1980s, there was an opportunity for a different type of peace, what I call a positive peace order, one which refuses to accept the inevitable logic of conflict. Clearly, there's going to be difficulties and differences in the level of international politics. Yet there was a unique moment in which we could move to a different type of international affairs. This was certainly the idea underlying the new political thinking and perestroika in the Soviet Union. But there were plenty of people in the West as well who supported that idea. For example, the US ambassador, Jack Matlock, at the time, you know, very much so and still defends it, and so many others. What underlying the whole book, and I'll come back to the key point in a minute, but underlying it is the vision that humanity has had. You talk about psychology. Is this endless utopian striving? Socialism used to have it. Others, that we can, a better world is possible, that we don't have to divert so many resources into militarism, into permanent armed warfare, into permanent striving for dominance. After the end of the Cold War, we could have gone back to the founding principles of the United Nations, of the charter system which we're living under today.
The Cold War, even though we call it a war, it was also a period when various camps tried to manage their differences in a very tenuous and yet peaceful way. Did the Cold War really need to be prevented as much as perhaps redefined and prolonged?
Yeah, what I call the first Cold War, nobody calls now the first Cold War, was indeed about how to manage conflict and in conditions of nuclear, the Armageddon and apocalypse hanging over our heads. So the idea was that it was managed, but it wasn't without conflict, of course, because the conflict was fought out in what we used to call the Third World, in Vietnam, Korea, Africa, and so many other conflicts, Asia. But we lost that ability to manage conflict at the end of the First Cold War. And of course, today we've ended up in a far more dangerous Second Cold War. But I must stress, though, that the idea of this international system, the charter system, is important because it still to this day offers an opportunity for this more positive peace. The Indians talk about it, the Chinese talk about it, Russians talk about it. In the West, there's plenty of people who would like to see this positive peace. But to achieve it, we must fight for it and understand what it's...
Let's try to understand it, because if we step outside these Russian-Western tensions for a moment and look at the wider global political processes, you argue that there has been a sort of a switch in perception or a switch in hierarchy. What used to be a part of the global system, an important part of the global system, by which I mean the collective West, came to believe that it was in fact the entire system, and that it not only could but should be setting rules and writing prescriptions for everybody else. What's behind this conceptual turnaround?
Yes, what I argue is that this, what I call the political West, did engage in, and it, the tension was there from the beginning, began to usurp, if you like, the norms and rules of the an international law itself, represented by the charter system of the United Nations. This usurpation is, you know, was driven by, you know, important normative ideas. You know, it delivered many public goods, the so-called collective West. But of course, it was not the entirety of the world, and it simply could not, after 1989, the Soviet Union collapsed, China was still relatively marginal to the international politics. And so the collective West, the political West, believed that its vision of the world, its institutions and its norms would become universal. There were plenty of good things in that package, but there was one very bad thing, and that is geopolitical dominance, which clearly many states would refuse to accept.
Well, Professor Sakwa, what strikes me the most about this concept and this switch from what you call democratic internationalism embedded within the UN Charter, this idea that each nation deals with its own problems by itself, but we all cooperate, to the idea of democratic internationalism, and to what to me looks more like democratic extinctionism, because this is an idea that not only that all nations should develop in one prescribed way, but that those nations that don't comply or for some reason simply cannot, physically cannot reproduce the Western system, that their own political systems have no right to exist. This is a, you know, this is not only an ahistorical idea. I think this idea goes against science. It goes against the entire human experience. And ultimately, it's simply not realistic. You cannot compress the diversity of human problems or collective experiences to just one paradigm. And I cannot even understand how something like that could pop into people's mind and, you know, become so prominent, because you would not try to do it even on your kid, because it's impossible, but to try it on the entire world, that seems to be, well, very big ambition.
We should distinguish, on the one hand, this democratic internationalism leads to, we call, not just me, democratism. That is where democracy is used as an instrument. The actual substantive notion of, you know, systems and regimes based on the rule of law, popular accountability, representation, and so on, is perhaps a universal in the sense that it's embedded in the United Nations Charter. But what's happened is that these ideas are then appropriated by a particular geopolitical system, which then proceeds to try to impose its particular vision of how the world should be run or how a society should be managed to the rest. And you're absolutely right. Civilizational diversity is precisely the big issue, which is now coming back very much onto the political stage.
Now, one, I think, valuable lesson that my country, Russia, has taken from its traumatic experience of the Soviet collapse is that you should not really try to take more than you can carry. And I think for many Russians, including for the Russian leadership, what's hard to understand is why would the West even want to take on such a humongous task when its own resources, not only material resources, but some would argue intellectual resources, are running so thin.
There were plenty of voices in the United States and in the political West after the end of the Cold War who made exactly that point. But unfortunately, the Cold War and the end of it had empowered what we call the neocons, the neoconservative movement, accompanied as well by much more empowered liberal internationalists who believed that liberal hegemony, what we talked about earlier, could become a universal model of governance. So these two forces effectively merged in a level of interventionism, which has universally failed. We've seen it in the invasion of Iraq. We've seen it in Libya. We've seen it in Afghanistan and other cases. So you're absolutely right that liberal hegemony, as many in the West would argue, has been a foolish and wasteful enterprise. Instead of rebuilding our domestic societies, we've tried to impose this model externally, which, of course, states simply will not accept, which has led to this conflict and led to the Second Cold War.
I think right now the Western political class chooses to frame it as a struggle between authoritarianism and democracy. And I think the central variable sort of in this juxtaposition is not only power, but potency, the ability or disability to implement your vision of governance, your vision of good life in real life. I wonder, to what extent do you think this struggle with the so-called authoritarian East is prompted by the West's own ability or inability to deliver what it stands for to its own people?
Yeah, this argument is applied to a lot of states, including Russia, that it's the diversionary argument. Your failure to deal with domestic issues leads you to adventurism abroad. Certainly, as far as the West is concerned, we've clearly, I've been certainly arguing this for many years, that we should really get our own house in order before telling other people how to manage their own houses. This doesn't mean to say that we don't have, we all, as individuals and as societies, have a right to demand obeisance or support for those principles of the charter system of the United Nations. These are not principles which are, you know, Chinese, American, Russian, or Indian, or whatever. These are genuinely a sense of, at the end of the Second World War, such a catastrophic disaster, Russia lost at least 27 million people. The idea of never again, both for the genocides and the mass killings and everything, we really must get back to that vision. Unfortunately, the younger generation has forgotten that those principles, and we have to work for it, and everybody has to accept and work within that framework.
Professor Sekwa, while Russia surely strongly supports the UN Charter, I think there is also a clear difference in how various nations are interpreting those principles and what matters more for various societies. For example, the Chinese most recently have been putting a lot of stress on the collective right to development, which allows the individual to live you know, his or her own full potential, but also in connection with the society. Now, the West tends to be far more individualistic and stressing the rights of individuals more than the rights of the collectives. But again, if we look at modern-day psychological and neurological research, we can see that human potential is better developed not in isolation of individual life, but rather in connection with the community, in being mutually engaged with the community. So many of those issues, I think they are at the core of the current disagreements, and yet somehow we all accept only the Western experience of this dynamic between the individual and the collective. Do you think there's any room for, you know, broader dialogue on what it means, what the, you know, the UN Charter and what the Declaration of Human Rights actually mean in this life, in this time, and for various societies?
Absolutely. I think that's the fundamental question, is that we do need that dialogue on what an agenda for peace and development could mean today within the framework of charter internationalism. So it's not just that societies cannot survive on their own, but they need a genuine sense of internationalism based not on somebody imposing the way that this internationalism should work, but emerging from your own distinctive destiny. This, of course, applies to the collective internally, that some societies have a more collectivist vision of public goods. The West, of course, has undermined very strongly, and particularly the Anglo-Saxon world, but not just only. The neoliberal evisceration or hollowing out of the state has been catastrophic. We've seen that in our deindustrialization, and there hasn't been for a generation now a genuine attempt to say, how can we make these societies more equal, more dynamic, more successful, instead of which lots of parts of the Midwest, old industrial belts and so on, are declining and continue, and the social problems are enormous. Really, that's exactly it. We should have a, you know, a focus on dealing with our own problems, but in partnership with others, in the sense that that's why we do need this positive peace, not just endless negative peace, the absence of war. And even that we're not succeeding in doing.
Well, Professor Sekwa, in partnership with each other, we need to take a very short break right now, but I hope to be back to this discussion in a few minutes. Stay tuned.
It's amazing what can happen over the course of a few months. Not long ago, Biden was emphatic that the U.S. would back Ukraine as long as it takes. Now it is as long as we can. What happened? No doubt the regime in Kiev has taken note.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Richard Sakwa, Professor Emeritus of Russian and European Politics at the University of Kent. Professor Sakwa, I don't know if it's true universally, but certainly in Russia, and I would claim to some extent in Ukraine, the notion of Western-style democracy, let's say like 30, maybe 20 years ago, was very tightly associated with living standards and the lifestyle perks that came with material success. And this is something that I think the so-called authoritarian governments are increasingly better able to provide for their people, whereas I would claim, and I think you partially supported my argument, Western governments are sort of losing their track of providing, or what it means to be providing, some social benefits for their people. I wonder if without this lifestyle allure, the notion of Western democracy would be just as attractive, not only to people outside the West, but also to Western populations.
Well, democracy comes in all shapes and sizes in the West as well. There are certain fundamental principles, of course, at its heart. Who can deliver the goods? Of course, the big test was the COVID emergency. And many now argue that the authoritarian states ultimately were not much more successful. Obviously, the United States was deeply unsuccessful, but in between, there were all sorts of measures. It's not even a question of East and West here. This is why really I do feel that we do need to have this dialogue to which you referred to earlier, which I think is extremely important, on what does the United Nations, what do these charter principles and what does the Universal Declaration of Human Rights means today? What does it mean today? Not just to use it as a demagogic or geopolitical purposes, but really go back to that founding idea. You in an earlier discussion talked about the Chinese vision of what they could contribute to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There was a fantastic debate at that time. We need a similar debate, instead of which one person telling the other how they should live. That's just a total dead end.
But to some extent, this debate is already happening all around the world. For example, the Chinese has just hosted a major conference on that very declaration because it just marked the 75th anniversary of it being signed. And they talked extensively about security, collective development, and civilizational dialogue as something that provides for human rights. And I was particularly struck by this idea of civilizational dialogue as a sort of a safeguard for the excesses of any particular national model. So, for example, they would see that as a sort of a new version of checks and balances and keeping or making sure that, you know, we develop but also take care of the planet, take care of the income gap, etc. I would claim that Russia is also trying to develop those ties with many of the African countries. At the African summit in summer, I remember Putin talked extensively about offering, not imposing, but offering Russian governing technologies to African countries. And we are not talking about political systems here. We are talking about mechanical, algorithmical ways of providing services to the population. So to some extent, this is already happening and many countries are participating. It just seems to me that it's the Western part of humanity or Western political class that are sort of locked in the high tower where they're debating of how they can continue being the gods for the rest of the world.
Yeah. We talked about the international system, the UN-based system, but yeah, in international politics, the state system has matured. There's some 200 states in the world. Decolonization is not entirely over, but basically it's in the past. And these states now have matured and they demand their voice in the conduct of international politics. And this is a paradigm shift, an epochal change. In which obviously China is taking a lead, for example, in its a whole stack of documents have come out recently, Strategic Security Initiative, all those other initiatives. I very much welcome it because this, as you say, is part of a global debate, and this debate can no longer be restricted to the so-called states of the G7 or the advanced or the political West. The political West, everyone has to find its new niche in the new configuration of international politics. Unfortunately, some people are still looking to past preeminence, past dominance, both intellectual and geopolitical and military, and that's no way forwards.
Now, one thing that I found very interesting in your writing is that you make this distinction between the cultural West or civilizational West with its roots back in the Greek culture and Roman law, and the political West as an entity that took shape during the Cold War, which you described as militaristic, expansionist, and hermetic, and perhaps I would add impermeable to objections of others and impermeable to self-correction. That's the biggest difficulty, I think, for the Western populations. And this is actually what my question is about. I think that kind of framing would understandably cause resentment from other countries. But what about the resentment from the inside? What's the relationship between the power and the people within the West? And do you think more generally people are sort of satisfied with what they're getting from their elites?
No, they're not at all satisfied. And this explains in part the emergence of so-called populism, both of the left and the right. There's major crises. It's not just migration issues. It's actually developmental issues. And what sort of vision for the future do these societies have? And it's a total bankruptcy in looking to the future. And the fact that, you know, the political West is still locked in a vision of international politics, which is already way outdated. And this is why I say, though, that within the West, there are many Wests. So, you know, I'm from the West. I want to see it prosper. I want it to shift away from its messianic vision of a very narrow type of politicized international politics, thinking about more development, thinking about the public good and delivery of services and so on, and of, you know, for all of our societies to be incorporated into a, you know, prosperous, forward-looking future of the future, into the future, rather than stuck into the militarism of that of the Cold War. If I have one more second on this, is to say that you say there are, in other words, the many Wests. There is this deep cultural West which provides resources for the renewal of the West, and is also the civilizational West, which is, you know, both the good sides of it, Renaissance, Enlightenment thinking, but also the downside, imperialism, colonialism, exploitation, and so on, which we're only beginning to come to terms with our own civilizational West, all this culture wars in part reflected. So the collective West is going through, or the West is going through, a period of major challenges now. And in the sense that this debate, which we're having now, I think, can contribute to, you know, maybe getting out of it.
Well, one obstacle to that is working in the Kremlin. I mean, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. And you quite often, Professor Sakwa, make a point that the West essentially forced or made Vladimir Putin into an enemy where he could have been a partner for the West. Let's focus on that lost hypothetical of how Putin could have been a partner to the West, or alternatively, how could the West have benefited from a more mutual, more reciprocal relationship with Russia under Putin?
This goes back precisely to when I say the lost peace, it was never established, unfortunately, but that potential. And at that moment, the end of the First Cold War, we had two visions of European security on offer. The Europe whole and free idea, which was put forwards by the United States deliberately to counter Gorbachev's common European home, or Mitterrand and Gaullist ideas of a pan-European continental unity. I believe that ultimately the two could have been compatible, and this is what Putin wanted to do when he first came to power. And they would have become, you know, the right of free choice and indivisibility of security are not ultimately incompatible if you can frame the question in a context in which people can choose what would actually achieve indivisibility of security. That, tragically, was unfortunately not allowed because the political West assumed its geopolitical and normative dominance was so overwhelming. Russia's view didn't matter. Putin, of course, tried to solve it asking to join NATO. But of course, if Russia joins NATO, then there's no point. If everyone is in NATO, then no one needs to be in NATO. And that was the paradox and the dilemma faced. And gradually, bit by bit, Putin became more and more alienated from the early times 2000 to the point at which we end up. And of course, as he became alienated, then he was demonized and diplomacy then died.
In his earlier years, as you mentioned in many articles, he was quite amenable to Western influence, to even Western guidance. I think he was pretty diligent in trying to find a middle ground. Why do you think Western politicians and the West in general, which is usually very good at spotting very, you know, good business-like ideas, why didn't they try to capitalize on that?
Some Western European politicians did understand that. Of course, they themselves became demonized. We're talking about Berlusconi, we're talking about even Jacques Chirac in his own way at a certain point. And this whole tendency was marginalized. That's why I think this concept of the political West is useful, because it shows that it is a type of hermetic, you say, impermeable to outside influences. It was so bound up with its own identity and its own achievements and its own then expansionary logic that it couldn't really take into account security, you know, the deepening security dilemma on the continent. That's why I've always been arguing that we do need a pan-continental European answer to European security questions. It isn't an anti-American statement. It's simply to say America can be a good partner, but it's not a very good, if you like, leader of an alliance system, which has long outlived its purpose. Of course, now they say it's got a new purpose, which is the original one, to contain Russia as it did the Soviet Union. But that's just taking us back to square one, and we need a new logic to get out of it.
Professor Sakwa, I noticed that Vladimir Putin uses a lot of feudal terms in his speeches, or words like vassals or the sovereign. He often appeals to dignity, to honor, to valor. And maybe it's just me, but I'm hearing a lot of stylistic references to King Arthur's legends and the quest for the Holy Grail. And I wonder if you see these historic struggles between Russia and Great Britain, or Russia and the West more broadly, not only as a competition for control or power or access to resources, but also involving something larger, perhaps something metaphysical.
I definitely think there's something metaphysical there. I do think that, you know, there's a lot of studies of political theology, let alone political psychology. Indeed, the way that the West clings together, the political West, which is a very, in my view, anachronistic, an archaic form, maybe because the political form of an Atlantic alliance system was important against Nazi Germany and maybe in the early against the Soviet Union. Certainly, it's got no place today. And we should really move beyond that sort of thinking. Of course, there's plenty in the United States who argue the same. So that's why I say that, in a sense, you're quite right. Within the countries, we can't simply say they're homogenous. The political West is a homogenous force, but there are forces within the collective and larger historical West which are fighting against it. We used to have peace movements. We used to have trade union movements, which would be quite active in questioning this militarism in a way that international politics is militarized. So you're right that we do need a new agenda which can, you know, take us back. Maybe we do need to go back to the starting point, and that is not 1989, but 1945, that moment of destiny for the world.
Well, on this rather hopeful note, Professor Sakwa, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.